Where do you draw the line between cultural appreciation and appropriation or theft? I mean, for example, take popular music.
Everybody knows suburban white hip-hop boys who desperately, desperately want to be from the street and to have the credibility and the intensity of experience that they imagine belongs to the rappers that they're listening to. But I suppose the simplest way I can put it is that there's a difference between loving something and trying to own it.
Harry Kunzru takes on the complicated racial history of American music in his new novel, White Tears. It's a story of two white college friends, Seth and Carter. Seth's an audio geek. Carter's rich and an obsessive collector of early blues music. And one day, while he's wandering around New York City, Seth accidentally records a street musician singing what sounds to him like an old blues tune. The boys start mucking around with this recording with disastrous consequences.
These guys, they put the guitar line and the vocal together, and they throw a lot of hiss and crackle over the top of it and make it sound as if it's an authentic 1920s blues recording, and they put it out onto the internet, and they fool a lot of people. There are people imagining that they found a real old record, and they're very smug. And then an old collector gets in touch with them and says, "When did you get this record? I last heard this record in 1959 and they say, no, we made it up. And he says, "Oh no, you didn't." And at that point, the possibility emerges that they haven't made something, they've merely channeled something that wanted to be heard again. And I make it a ghost story about sound.
The song that the boys record, you wrote the lyrics for it. It's in the book. Can you hear it in your head? Is there an actual song you hear?
There's not a particular tune, but I mean, the secret of that song is that I didn't write it. Every couplet is a traditional couplet. Those things are all from blues and work songs. You know, that's the tradition talking. You know, I put me under a man called Captain Jack. He wrote his name all down my back. That's the kind of violence that was done to people. And Believe I Buy Me a Graveyard of My Own, put my enemies all down in the ground. That desire for revenge against your enemies and perhaps a magical revenge is also there in the blues tradition. There are many of these couplets, and they kind of float around and become, you know, they speak in a way that's more than individual, more than personal. And so I feel like, you know, from that point of view, I was just channeling something.
Mm. The ghost that stalks these boys is the ghost of this nameless musician. They call him Charlie Shaw. It's not at this point clear whether they invented Charlie Shaw or whether Charlie Shaw actually existed or possibly even still exists. He's sort of amorphous, and he seems to be stalking or hunting them. Tell me more about this ghost.
Well, ghost stories are always about repression, aren't they? I mean, a ghost story is always about something in the past that happened and was prematurely suppressed or forgotten, and that is trying to kind of punch its way out of the past into the present and kind of grab hold of people in the present. That's what's terrifying, being dragged back into the troubles of the past, into the horror of the past. And this figure from the 20s, a musician who was never recorded or perhaps was recorded, but somebody whose existence is in doubt, is kind of reaching forward into the present day and grabbing these two retro-loving white hipsters and forcing them into a kind of confrontation with the tradition that they rather kind of casually dabble in.
But there's a mythic element too. I mean, you clearly at a few points are alluding to the old legend about Robert Johnson, the idea that he sold his soul to the devil in exchange for musical talent.
Yeah, that's become the primal story of the blues. He went down to the crossroads and he got down on his knees and he sold his soul to the devil to learn to play guitar. And the idea of a kind of diabolical talent, or an idea that the blues has something of the dark side about it. But a lot of musicians, I think Johnson included, would spruce themselves up and play at the Sunday picnic and play some gospel songs. And then on a, you know, Saturday night would be in a juke singing completely different kind of music. which amuses me and I think shows a kind of pitfall for folk collecting and a kind of fetishization of authenticity, as if there are these musicians who've sort of risen up out of the river mud of the Delta, whereas actually some of them are much more sophisticated and worldly and modern than people give them credit for.
And that folk story, you know, that black Faustian figure who sells his soul to the devil for, you know, brilliance on the guitar or the fiddle, that story exists in more than one culture. I mean, it's not
absolutely
unique,
yes,
to hear. So then, which then makes it complicated because, you know, then you think, wow, this is possibly just a giant projection onto this music. And then whose soul is being stolen?
Yeah, right. I mean, having said that, there's a great deal of black magic around the edges of the blues. I mean, you think of the idea of the jinx. Mm. You know, I mean, there are some wonderful lyrics where, you know, the jinx is almost like a physical creature, like a cat or a wolf or something that's actually kind of prowling around your bed and, you know, bringing you bad luck as a kind of almost physical thing. And I mean, back to Robert Johnson, he has a famous song called Stones in My Passway, and that seems to be a fairly straightforward reference to West African footfall magic, where if you want to do harm to somebody else, you'll put a magical object where they'll have to tread on it or walk over it, and it will bring them harm or bring them luck. So somebody, you know, Johnson feels that somebody has cursed him.
At this point in the narrative, Seth sets out for the back roads of Mississippi trying to track down this mysterious, is it a musician, is it a ghost, and figure out what's happening. And he has this strong sense that this is somehow something he's done before, something that's kind of like replaying a record. It seems to me there's something you're saying here about history and repetition.
Doom, isn't it? You know, this is a very future-oriented culture. I think, you know, I grew up in Britain, and it's noticeable to me in America that it's all, you know, orientated towards the future. And the flip side of that is that people are kind of uncomfortable with the past in some ways, partly because, you know, bad things were done to get us here. And I like the idea of watching a character who is haunted by the past.
I was also wondering whether in some ways you're also talking about or kind of channeling what it's felt like to be in America the last few years with, you know, the kind of racial violence and police shooting and, you know, people dying in police custody and the Black Lives Matter protests. There is, you know, kind of underneath the feeling of a certain inevitability to all of this, as though, you know, the seeds of this were planted so long ago and repressed, and it was only a matter of time.
If this novel has an origin moment for me, it's the moment quite soon after I arrived to live here when Barack Obama got elected, and suddenly all the media was full of, by and large, white people saying, well, welcome to a post-racial America. You know, we've done this now. A black man has become president. That means surely that this terrible history is over and we no longer need to look at it anymore. And it seemed that was done with such indecent haste. And it was a tell to me. It was a tell that there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of guilt that people wish to close down and didn't wish to face. And then, you know, and of course, instead of post-racial America, what have we got? You know, in the last few years, racial anxiety has bubbled up in this country. And so, I mean, I think of it, although it's a novel about the past and about history, it is trying to use that history to speak to our current predicament.
There's a scene near the end of the book that's a really powerful scene. Seth winds up in a graveyard at night on his knees. He's trying to beg for mercy, and he's not even sure who he's trying to beg for mercy from. I guess the question I have is, you know, we've been talking about the ghosts of unresolved, unfinished business of the past and about retribution and violence that repeats in cycles. Is it ever possible to lay that kind of ghost?
I think the only way to do that is to honestly face that history and also to know that in a certain, very particular way, it's not really about your personal guilt or innocence. You know, it's not about you. And rather than thinking of your personal absolution or, you know, your personal sort of escape from the past, I mean, I think it's much more important to look at the structures, the material conditions. You know, I'm very struck by what continuity there is between the kind of practices that were used to control black people in the period of the Reconstruction, you know, after slavery, and the kind of penal practices and the policing practices now. I mean, you look at what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, which became the sort of flashpoint for this new civil rights movement. And that had a great deal to do with a kind of policing that would have been completely familiar to the people in Mississippi in 1925. Mm-hmm. And all this survives in structures. It survives in flows of money and power. And that's the way to solve this, is to address these questions rather than, you know, trying to wriggle out of your personal feelings of guilt.
Harry Kunzru, his new novel is called White Tears.